Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this afternoon's press conference on some late-breaking science from AACR Journals on the topic of personalized medicine. I'll now hand the press conference over to our moderator, who is Dr. Lewis C. Cantley, Director of the Cancer Center at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston and a co-editor-in-chief of the Cancer Discovery, the newest journal of the American Association for Cancer Research. Dr. Cantley.
Thank you, Jeremy. So we have today three speakers who are presenting research from articles recently published in AACR related journals. And they all have a common theme of being, first of all, articles that we think are very relevant for clinical impact. And so without further ado, I will introduce the first speaker, Michael Milosevic, who has some very exciting data on hypoxia or low levels of oxygen in the tumor microenvironment of prostate cancer influencing outcome. So, or correlating, I should say, with outcome. And so without further ado, Michael, you can take over.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the invitation to be here today. First of all, to start with, prostate cancer, as many of you know, is the most common cancer in men in North America right now. And most men who are diagnosed with prostate cancer have disease that is confined to the prostate gland. And in that setting, doctors use a variety of clinical parameters like the stage or the Gleason score or prostate-specific antigen level to decide on treatment. And generally speaking, for men who have cancer that is confined to the prostate gland, either surgery or radiotherapy are equally effective treatments. And in many cases, it's the choice of the patient to try to decide which one he prefers. Approximately 25% of men, however, will have a recurrence of their prostate cancer after either surgery or radiotherapy. And so this brings up, this raises the issue of how can we do better, how can we actually tailor treatment more specifically to the needs of these men, and it speaks quite importantly to the need for more personalized cancer treatments. And when we think about radiation treatment in particular for prostate cancer, there's two ways that people are exploring these days for personalizing treatment for men with prostate cancer. One is to deliver the radiation treatment in a more precise manner, as shown on the left side. This involves specialized imaging techniques and specialized delivery techniques called intensity-modulated radiation, for example, that allow the prostate gland to be targeted very precisely and the normal tissues around the prostate gland to be spared. Thereby hopefully improving cure rates and reducing side effects. The other broad way is to think about the biology of the prostate cancer. Why do some tumors progress after treatment and other tumors do not? And the focus of this talk today is a specific aspect of prostate cancer biology relating to prostate cancer hypoxia. Now, hypoxia, as you just heard, really refers to low levels of oxygen in the tissues or in the area around the cells. And most normal organs and tissues in our bodies have high levels of oxygen, and in fact, oxygen levels that are quite high are necessary for the survival and normal function of those organs and systems. But it's been known for quite some time from laboratory studies that most solid tumors, such as prostate cancer, actually have low levels of oxygen or hypoxia. And this arises for a variety of complicated reasons that relate to how oxygen is delivered to those cancers because of abnormalities of blood vessels, and also because of differences in how the oxygen is used within those cancers, consumption effects. And over the years, we've learned that largely based on laboratory studies, that hypoxia can have several adverse consequences in tumors. It changes the behaviors of tumors so that they behave more aggressively and invade locally into tissues adjacent to where they actually begin. It can cause cancer to spread or metastasize, we often refer to other areas of the body, and it reduces the effectiveness of some treatments like radiotherapy. So, one of the questions that had really not been addressed in any way several years ago is whether or not prostate cancer contains regions of hypoxia and whether or not these kinds of implications also apply to our men with prostate cancer. So we set out in the late 1990s to put together a prospective clinical study where we would measure hypoxia in the prostate cancer of men prior to receiving radiation treatment. And these men all had intermediate-risk prostate cancer, which really refers to cancer that's confined to the prostate gland. We studied 247 men between 1999 and 2006. Hypoxia in these tumors was measured using a specialized hypoxia or oxygen sensor that was mounted on the tip of a very fine needle, and the measurements were made just prior to the start of their radiation treatment. They then went on to receive the high-precision radiation treatment that I referred to earlier, to higher than usual doses of radiation as well, again trying to combine those two ways of personalizing treatment. And then we followed these men. We watched their outcome to see how they would do for a median duration of 6.5 years, and we're continuing to follow them at the present time. And the endpoint that we used for this analysis is a rising prostate-specific antigen level, PSA, which is a recognized surrogate for outcome in many clinical studies of men with prostate cancer. The results, we found in this study that men who had hypoxic prostate cancer actually had their cancers come back earlier, actually had them come back more often than men who had well-oxygenated tumors, and also the cancers came back at a much earlier time frame. Men with intermediate prostate cancer, intermediate risk prostate cancer, their disease often has a very protracted course over many, many years. And sometimes we don't see recurrences for 5, 6, 7, or 8 years. In this study, most of the men who had their prostate cancer come back. In the group that had hypoxic tumors, those recurrences occurred typically within 2 or 3 years of finishing treatment. So the interpretation of these results and where we want to go next with this, we believe that this study provides very intriguing first evidence that, first of all, prostate cancer is hypoxic, and second, that hypoxia may be involved in influencing the outcome of men who are treated with radiation treatment. As we move forward, we continue to follow these men. We want to learn more about whether or not hypoxia actually correlates with survival of these men, so we will continue to follow them over time. We're also investigating new ways of measuring hypoxia in prostate cancer so that the results of this study could be translated to a much larger study, perhaps at multiple centers in North America, in the context of large phase clinical studies or clinical trials, so that we can get more information about this phenomenon. And lastly, probably the most exciting thing in the context of personalized cancer medicine is the concept that if these tumors are hypoxic, if we can identify hypoxic tumors, the next step is, can we do something about it? And there are new treatment strategies coming along all the time that specifically target aspects of hypoxia in cancer. And that may include, for example, new drugs, hypoxia-targeted drugs that we could combine with radiation treatment or other treatments and try to improve the outcome for these men. Thank you very much.
So thank you, Michael. As we said, we will hold questions until all three speakers are finished. So the next speaker is Ingo Mellinghoff, who's been working on EGF receptor mutations in glioblastoma and has some very interesting results with regard to EGF receptor inhibitors and reasons why they thus far have not been very effective in treating EGF receptor mutant glioblastomas. I should say that the talk we just heard was published online today in Clinical Cancer Research, and the article by Dr. Mellinghoff is coming out today in Cancer Discovery.
Thank you, Lou. So I would like to talk about our work on EGF receptor in brain cancers. This cartoon shows you where the EGF receptor is positioned. It is a protein that is a transmembrane protein, so there's an extracellular part to it, and there's an intracellular part to it. And the EGF receptor is in a family of receptors that's called the EGF receptor family, and another prominent member in that family is HER2 that you are likely familiar with from breast cancer. So there are already FDA-approved strategies to block EGF receptor in cancer, and those strategies include both antibodies that bind to the outside of the receptor and small molecules that bind to the kinase domain inside of the cell. This slide is a reminder that in lung cancer, EGF receptor kinase inhibitors have shown clear activity and have received regulatory approval, and about 10% of non-small cell lung cancers harbor mutations in the kinase domain, in the intracellular part of the protein. And when allotinib is given only to patients who carry such mutations in their tumors, the response rate is up to 70%. So it's an effective treatment for lung cancer with these kinase domain mutations. The puzzling piece is, why have EGF receptor kinase inhibitors not clinically been effective in glioblastoma, which is another cancer type, a brain cancer, the most malignant human brain tumor? And what's puzzling is that about 40% of these brain tumors also have a genetic alteration in EGFR. So you would intuitively assume that in that cancer type, these drugs should also work. So what is it? Where is the answer to that puzzle? So one interesting detail regarding the mutations in EGF receptor in glioblastoma versus lung cancer is that they map to different parts of the protein. So up here you see the extracellular part of the receptor that carries the mutations that we find in glioblastoma in brain cancer. You see there are these red areas are mutations in glioblastoma. Some are missense mutations, and there's one in-frame deletion called EGF receptor variant 3. On the right side of this cartoon, you see the kinase domain of the receptor, and that's where all the mutations are in lung cancer. So the question we're trying to answer in this particular project is, do glioblastoma cells that harbor an extracellular domain mutation require EGF receptor for survival? Are they addicted to EGF receptor, as are lung cancer cells with kinase domain mutations? So that's the first question. And if so, do they respond to the same type of EGF receptor inhibitor? So to answer these questions, we at postdoc in my laboratory, Igor Vivanko, knocked down EGF receptor in cell lines that harbor such a mutation, glioblastoma cell lines that harbor an EGF receptor mutation, and many other cell lines that don't harbor such a mutation. And when we then looked at the cell death induction, we found that the only cells that were killed by knocking down EGF receptor were the ones that harbor this extracellular domain missense mutation, indicating that, yes, these cells indeed require EGFR for survival. So the next question was, how about small molecule inhibitors? And that was, for us, the most interesting part of this study. We compared two different EGF receptor inhibitors. Both actually are FDA-approved. Erlotinib is FDA-approved for the treatment of EGFR mutant lung cancer, and lapatinib is actually FDA-approved for HER2-positive breast cancer, so it's an EGFR and HER2 inhibitor. And when we looked at the response of glioblastoma cell lines to these two EGF receptor kinase inhibitors, you can see that lapatinib inhibits the phosphorylation of EGF receptor very nicely versus erlotinib, which really doesn't. And if you do the exact same experiment in lung cancer cell lines with a kinase domain mutation, you see the opposite result, that erlotinib inhibits nicely the EGF receptor phosphorylation, but lapatinib is much inferior. And we have done similar experiments in many other cell lines. We also reconstituted the glioblastoma mutations in cell lines in a cell line that doesn't have EGF receptor. And again, the inactive conformation binder lapatinib much more potently blocks EGF receptor. So the question for us then became, how about patients with glioblastoma? Does lapatinib, if it's biochemically so compelling, does it get into the brain tumor tissue in glioblastoma patients? Does it turn off EGF receptor, and how much drug are you able to deliver to the brain tumors? So that was examined in the context of a clinical trial, and Tim Clousey was a lead investigator in this study with other NABTC investigators. And the patients received lapatinib prior to surgery, then they had brain tumor surgery, and we examined in the surgical specimen drug concentrations and EGF receptor inhibition. And the finding of this clinical trial in terms of the biomarkers was that, yes, lapatinib very potently does inhibit EGF receptor compared to about 60 control tumors that we examined. So the red diamonds are the lapatinib-treated patients, and the other empty circles are tumors from patients who did not receive lapatinib. So clearly EGF receptor phosphorylation is suppressed, but there also clearly is residual phosphorylation. So it's good, but it's not good enough at this particular dose. So we looked at concentrations of lapatinib in all these different human tumor samples, and we found that the concentration of lapatinib is between 500 and 1,000 nanomoles, and that is unfortunately below the concentration of drug that you need in these different cell lines to induce cell death. So an important question for us then are, how much do you need to inhibit EGFR to induce cell death in glioblastoma? And the answer is very much. You need to almost completely shut it down. So to prove that, this is in a genetic experiment where we knocked down EGF receptor to different degrees by titration of a hairpin. And you will see that only when you almost completely knock down EGF receptor and you completely abolish phosphorylation of the receptor do you see good cell death induction. So what have we learned from this? I think we have learned that glioblastoma cells that harbor these extracellular domain missense mutations are indeed addicted to EGFR, so there is an opportunity to target this, as cancer cell addiction has been shown in other contexts. We have also learned that lapatinib and inactive conformation binders seem to be superior to erlotinib and other active conformation binders, and the future directions for this project is to test the preclinical activity of other type 2 EGF receptor kinase inhibitors in preclinical glioma models, such as the ones we have used. We have the green light from GSK to conduct a clinical trial with intermittent high-dose lapatinib. That seems to be the next logical step to examine its activity in glioblastoma. And in the laboratory, we want to understand how the extracellular domain and the intracellular domain communicate with each other. Thank you.
So our next speaker is Michael Evans, also from Sloan Kettering, and also who just is published online at Cancer Discovery today. And his talk concerns the discovery of a new technique for visualizing metastasized prostate cancer and monitoring it quantitatively, utilizing a radioactive form of an antibody against PSA.
Thank you. So one of the major unmet clinical needs for the prostate cancer community, as well as for other cancers, is the development of non-invasive imaging markers that can give us some sense of the pathological activation or the inhibition of key biological pathways for the respective cancer. In prostate cancer, we appreciated that the androgen receptor, which I've indicated is AR up here, is deeply relevant to all stages of the disease. It's very druggable, but drug responses, both in early stages of the disease and then ultimately in the latest stage of the disease, can be variable and transient, which underscores the need for non-invasive markers that can help us to capture the biological diversity of the disease. So in collaboration with other investigators at MSKCC, we developed a radio tracer targeting the form of prostate-specific antigen that pools in the tumor microenvironment. We targeted prostate-specific antigen because it is the secreted form of the protein is a clinically validated biomarker of certain aspects of prostate cancer, though it has considerable limitations. And so on that grounds, we thought that if we just changed the way in which we measured PSA, we could reveal new and useful information beyond that conferred by the serum measurement. So one of the more exciting applications for the radio tracer after conducting some proof of concept studies was our ability to detect modulation of AR pathway signaling output with an antiandrogen, and the scheme is outlined here. The conceptual idea is that in the context of pathological activation of AR, there would be quite a bit of PSA in the tumor microenvironment. By applying the radio tracer, we could score the lesion very well by PET. And after initiating therapy and turning off the androgen receptor pathway, the decrease in PSA secretion reflective of inhibited AR could also be quantified by PET. And so this is the most compelling proof of concept data that we have to this end. So these are small. These are animal imaging experiments which mice were given subcutaneous prostate cancer tumors. These prostate cancer tumors express AR and express PSA. And we can distinguish three individual treatment arms that are designed to modulate the activity of the AR signaling pathway. On the left is a condition in which we're stimulating AR signaling and PSA production, and T with the arrow is indicating the site of the tumor. As you can see on the color scale, the tumor scores extremely well by PET. Oh, sure, thanks. So on the color scale, the tumor scores extremely well by PET under conditions of activation of AR and PSA, modestly well if we do nothing to the animal, and if we treat the animal for a week with Medivation 3100, which is an antiandrogen that just passed through phase 3 clinical trials, we can completely shut down the PET signal. And so we think conceptually the future of this radiotracer will be both in staging and seeing disease, because that is an important milestone, but also serving as an important response indicator for experimental therapeutics and potentially helping us more effectively stratify patient populations into responders versus non-responders on the basis of a truly tumor-specific biological response rather than, say, a crude measure of overall health, which is kind of the state of the field right now in positron emission tomography. Just to put this in perspective as well, we know that other clinically validated imaging biomarkers do not nearly perform as well in this preclinical setting. Things like 18-FDG, which is the standard or gold standard, I guess I should say, PET scan. So this is the preclinical proof of concept. At this point, we're very much interested in conducting first-in-man studies to try and prove to ourselves that we can see clinical disease. And thank you for your time.
Okay, the floor is now open for questions for all three speakers.
Great. Just before we start for questions, just remember that if you do have a question, wait for a staff member to hand you a microphone. If you're joining us over the telephone, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad, and we'll start with questions from the room.
Yeah, this is for Dr. Mellinghoff, Carmen Phillips at the NCI Cancer Bulletin. Can you talk more about the trial, the lapatinib trial? Just a few more details, and then also, are there other type 2 EGFR inhibitors out there that could also be tested?
So the trial I was referring to will be an upfront study where lapatinib will be given instead of 750 BID in the current study at 2 grams twice a day. And it will be a study in the upfront setting after initial diagnosis. It will be combined with standard therapy, which is radiation and Tamadar, together with lapatinib. And the biomarkers will be collected, tumor tissue will be collected prior to enrollment, and we'll do our very best to enrich for EGF receptor overactive tumor types. That's the clinical study that has been approved by GSK. Protocol is written and is going through the final stages of IRB approval, and will be conducted at UCLA at Memorial Sloan Kettering. Investigator-initiated. And your second question, sorry, can you repeat it? Oh, other type 2 inhibitors. So there's this compound called HKI-272. It's an irreversible inhibitor as opposed to lapatinib, which is a reversible inhibitor. They both bind to the ATP pocket of the kinase domain. So HKI-272 would be another drug, for example, that would fit in the same paradigm.
I'm Sally Church from Pharma Strategy Blog. I have a question for Dr. Milosevic about the tumor hypoxia. And you mentioned that there were several new developments in this area for future directions. My question, though, is that as far as I can remember, tumors tend to have hypoxia only in certain areas. The whole tumor isn't hypoxic. So how do you know if you were targeting it with an agent, but you're actually getting it into the hypoxic area and not the normoxic area?
That's actually right. There's quite a bit of variability in oxygen status of tumors, and that fluctuates over time as well, so it's not constant. And that is a challenge with these kinds of tumors. But the drugs that are being developed now, for example, one class of drugs is selectively toxic to hypoxic cells and tumors. So it is only activated in the areas of the tumor where hypoxia may exist. It's activated by that hypoxic environment. So it's less toxic, we hope, to the other adjacent tissues that may be better oxygenated. So you can use that kind of an agent, for example, in combination with radiation and hope that the radiation kills the better oxygenated cells and this new agent, the poorly oxygenated cells. For example, that's one mechanism.
while we're waiting for the next speaker, just a slight follow-up on that. In the context of hypoxia, tumors actually often produce higher levels of ROS, which, of course, radiation also causes, which is part of the death mechanism. So one could argue that persistent high levels of endogenous ROS essentially ultimately makes the tumor resistant to that approach for killing it. Do you have any insight into that possibility?
No, I think that all of those things need to be explored as we go forward. There, you know, we can target hypoxia specifically. There are other aspects, though, in terms of targeting downstream effects of hypoxia. We know, for example, that that hypoxia alters DNA repair capacity, for example, under some circumstances, and makes some tumors more susceptible to treatment with things like PARP inhibitors. So there's many, many strategies for kind of approaching this. One is to say we're going to target hypoxia specifically in these tumors. Another is to say that we're going to look and target some of the downstream manifestations of hypoxia within the tumors. And these are all under exploration right now.
Defer just a couple of clarification questions for Dr. Milosevic. Peter Drofford, Biotech Strategy Blog. In terms of prostate cancer, could you just clarify, first of all, how all the men in your trial had a similar type of prostate cancer in terms of risk stratification and where they were in terms of their diagnosis to ensure that obviously they were comparable? That's my first question. The second one is, you mentioned the word recurrence. Could you explain what you mean by that? As to, was that metastasis, was that rising PSA, what was your definition of recurrence, and what evidence do we have that hypoxia is linked to survival in prostate cancer, would be my third point. The fourth one was, you use radiotherapy. Is there any evidence that radiotherapy could be having an impact versus as compared to using surgery or other methodology here?
So I'll take those one step at a time. First of all, men with prostate cancer are clinically classified as having low, intermediate, or high-risk disease at diagnosis. That's fairly common. That's based on stage, Gleason score, which is a measure of the histologic grade of their tumor, and prostate-specific antigen level. The men in this study all had intermediate-risk prostate cancer, which is probably the largest group of men that are out there. Within that category, though, of intermediate risk, there is huge variability in terms of the characteristics of these men, in terms of how they're likely to do with either radical prostatectomy or with radiotherapy. And that highlights really the need to better understand some of the biologic aspects of these tumors and be able to tailor treatments in a more personalized way to more than just what we can measure on a clinical basis very easily. So that group of men was selected very specifically because they're a challenging group in the clinic to manage. That was, I think, the answer to the first question. Your second part again, please.
My second was recurrence. I've got a follow-up to your first point, so I may come back to that. First of all, intermediate, we've seen a lot of data about the PIVOT trial where men with watchful waiting have the same survival except in high-risk patients. So therefore, I go back to the issue of intermediate patients who are obviously having therapy versus, would there be a need to actually do this study in those who are watchful waiting as well to be sure what was going on there versus surgery?
I think that's a very good point. We don't know. It's certainly in some men, watchful waiting or simply observing them over time with some clinical endpoint as a trigger perhaps for treatment going forward is appropriate. And we don't necessarily know within that population which men are more likely to progress or not. And things such as this, the environment, the hypoxic microenvironment within tumors leading to tumor progression over time, increases in Gleason score over time, for example, or progression beyond the prostate gland could well be important. Hypoxia is only one piece of this story, though, I think, because it's the integrated microenvironmental effects coupled to the cellular compartment and changes in gene expression that is most important in this group.
My second point was on recurrence. My second point was on recurrence. Could you explain what that meant in the context of this study?
So recurrence in the context of this study is a rising PSA that meets standardized definitions of recurrence that people have used previously in clinical studies that are validated. It's not a perfect endpoint, which is why I said that we need to follow these men for longer periods of time and watch them to see if these results also correlate with long-term survival. We have a secondary endpoint in the study, which was biopsies of the prostate that were performed after treatment. This happened in only a subset of the men in the study, which has the potential to introduce bias because it didn't happen in every patient. And in that subset of men who had biopsies done, those patients who had evidence of recurrent cancer in their prostate gland, so a much more objective endpoint, also had more hypoxic tumors. But we have to treat that endpoint with some, we have to be careful about that because it's a subgroup analysis of a much larger cohort of 247 men.
David Sanz from Alpun in Barcelona. My question for the in vivo biomarker, if I'm not wrong, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there are 10 million PSA tests performed a year in the U.S. However, there are only 241,000 prescribed prostate cancers based on biopsy, meaning the PSA is a very bad predictor of cancer. However, I like to understand your in vivo biomarker. You mentioned it follows PSA. I like to understand what's the rationale for doing that. In other words, the PSA costs 25 cents. Your biomarker, I'm sure, will be more expensive. What are the benefits of having this in vivo biomarker? It seems like it is that the problem today is not as much the screening. It doesn't seem to be the visualization, since you can do a Da Vinci if you're doing surgery. So where do you see the benefits of this in vivo biomarker? What data, what additional data can you obtain based on PSA?
Sure. So I'd answer that question in a couple of ways. The first way is I'd say that one of the attractive aspects of targeting PSA is that it is a flawed biomarker. In the clinic, one of the major challenges to getting radiotracers approved by regulatory agencies is demonstrating a clear clinical benefit. So we reasoned that if there's a scenario in which PSA fails to do something that we think it ought to do, that's a situation in which we could take the biomarker and apply it in that clinical setting to see if we're revealing any new and useful information beyond that conferred by the PSA measurement. I'd more specifically say I think the fate of this radiotracer is probably in the context of advanced disease, castration-resistant prostate cancer, rather than upfront, as is the case with most PET radiotracers. PET and screening don't necessarily come up in the same sentence together. I think that because of the documented molecular heterogeneity of prostate cancer, castration-resistant prostate cancer, measuring biological responses to targeted therapies with imaging reagents can potentially tell us more than that of a serum biomarker, which averages a signal of response across multiple different potentially heterogeneous metastatic lesions. It's an open question to some extent, but it's a question that we have to address because not knowing is just, you know, having your head in the sand, essentially.
Actually, I could amplify on that a little bit. This is not unrelated to the question from the former question, in that we all agree after, so this is to be used after the patient already has been treated for prostate cancer, is now in the metastatic setting, and you want to know how their disease is progressing or whether it has recurred with some evidence of PSA rising and whether the therapy you're giving is having any benefit. And as with the question that was stimulated here, we don't have a whole lot of confidence that monitoring PSA in your bloodstream is going to be a good predictor that your therapy is working or not, while this approach would allow you to look at the setting of the tumor itself in the metastatic setting, the bone, to see whether you're seeing an influence directly on the tumor as opposed to the PSA level, which is not has not correlated well. I hope I'm not putting words in your mouth, Mike.
No, it's okay.
Further questions then from the room?
This is a question for the EGFR program. It's well known that Erbitux, an EGFR blocker, failed in lung. And in 2001, when it failed, when the FDA basically had no effect, it was devastating for the EGFR kind of program. What do you think that happened in the case of Erbitux if you have any understanding or any knowledge of that type of mutation. Rather, the question is, the mutations that you see on the EGFR receptor, the external part of the receptor, how do they interact with the monoclonal antibodies? You mentioned the intracellular mechanism, but how much have you elucidated from your studies on the external part of the receptor? What monoclonal antibodies have you analyzed, or what monoclonal antibodies you think can benefit from your analysis?
I think that's a terrific question, and we haven't really fully done that yet. You know, we started with the small molecule because we, if you read the paper and that came out just now, we were just struck by this sort of paradox between the lung and the brain mutations. You know, they're just being opposing pharmacologic responses. So we focused on the genetic experiments and other sets of inhibitors in the inside of the cell. Erbitux, there is some preclinical model in brain tumor models, preclinical data that suggests that it does have an activity. You know, so that particular experiment was done in Germany, and they put human patient-derived xenografts into mouse brains, and then infused Erbitux directly into that area with an infusion pump, and they noticed there was a marked decrease in proliferation, and there's some evidence of biological activity, Ki-67 drop. But how that and these particular xenografts that did respond had the EGF receptor variant 3 mutation, the truncation deletion, the inframe deletion. So my guess would be, based on that data, yeah, there may be a room for Erbitux in terms of its activity. We have not looked at the missense mutations. We're doing that right now. And I think one of the important questions that remains for the brain tumor field is the delivery of these monoclonal antibodies into the brain. I think that's we don't really know if that can be done successfully.
So if we have no other questions, then...
Wait, one more from the front row, Dr.
One last question.
One burning question on the hypoxia. Is there any drug that has shown activity or has shown tumor shrinkage in hypoxia, specifically Synta Pharmaceuticals in Boston, failed big time on their hypoxia program? My question is there any precedent of drug activity, any precedent of any benefit on targeting hypoxia?
There have been several drugs. It's a good question, actually. There have been several drugs over the years that have actually targeted hypoxia. The best known, probably the most recently known, was terapazamine, which was used in a series of head and neck studies, or two head and neck studies, and those studies were negative. And there may have been many issues for that, one of which is that not all tumors are hypoxic, yet all of these studies accrued patients regardless of whether or not they had hypoxic tumors. So we know from our study with men with prostate cancer, for example, that only about a third of those men had hypoxic tumors by whatever by the definition we chose to use. There can be some variability in there because there is heterogeneity within tumors. But in order to be able to show the benefit of a drug, or for that matter, in order to personalize treatment for patients in the way in which we want to moving forward, you need to be able to measure hypoxia in a robust and reproducible manner and then only give the drug to those patients. So one of the factors that has haunted us in the clinical community over the years is an inability to measure hypoxia properly in the context of clinical trials. And we were able to do it in this study using a very specialized technique. It's not going to be applicable to a big clinical study. So the focus of a lot of work right now is looking at other ways of actually documenting hypoxia, and that may be based on a gene signature, for example, that comes from the diagnostic biopsy that is done in men. Or alternatively, PET imaging tracers are also kind of exciting. And there's also MRI techniques that could be used in the future to diagnose hypoxia. So I think that the answer is there have been drugs that have been clinically active, and there are new drugs being developed right now that presumably, at least in a preclinical way, have better drug penetration and get at the hypoxic cells in a better way. The challenge is we need to be able to use these properly in the context of the clinical studies that we're using or going to do in the future.
I might add another possibility, which you might want to comment on, of visualizing hypoxia in a biopsy is by staining with IHC using antibodies against hypoxia-inducible factor or other genes that are regulated downstream of hypoxia-inducible factor. That's certainly been shown to work in some settings. Comment on that.
That's right, and there are several studies. There is at least one study in prostate cancer that has looked at HIF and HIF-related products that has shown a similar result to what we've shown. However, other things can regulate HIF as well, so it's not only hypoxia, although that's a very profound regulator of HIF. Altered changes in gene expression, for example, can upregulate HIF. So it's never quite certain what you're seeing when you look at HIF expression alone or downstream products of HIF. But there have been more recently a couple of gene signatures published that look at 15 or 20 genes from varying pathways, all of which tend to be hypoxia responsive. And these kinds of collections of multiple genes may actually be the way to go in the future.
Okay, if there are no further questions, we are out of time. So thank you very much to the presenters and the members of the media. On behalf of the AACR, this now concludes the call.